The following is a message from Pastor Ellis Orozco of First Baptist Richardson. For more information, please visit fbcr.org.
Giving my normal report, I realized that I'm asked to go to different churches, different associations across our convention on various occasions to talk about the dynamics of change, something that I have studied quite a bit in my 20-plus years of pastoring. And I realized I'd never really talked about it with you. And that doesn't seem right. But I'm trying to condense 2 hours of conference material into 30 minutes. So put your seatbelts on and get ready. We're going to talk about change. Change is a part of life. Always has been. Always will be. The problem today is not so much the need to change. There's always been that need. But it's the ever-changing need to change. That is to say that change is not the problem, but rather the rate of change, the speed of change today. The rate of change has increased dramatically over the last 50 years, and that is truly unprecedented in human history. It's kind of exciting in some ways that we are experiencing something that human beings throughout all of human history have never experienced. Now, there's always been change, and there have been long stretches of history where there's been very little change. And then there have been short times of history where there has been rather tumultuous change. But never in human history has the speed of change increased so rapidly the way it has in the last 50 years. I look at my father's generation. My dad is 81 years old. This year, and he'll be 82 this year. He's 82, just turned 82. Wonderful man. And I look at my dad, and I think, you know, it's really his generation, that World War II generation, what some call the greatest generation. It's really that generation that began all the changes, the technology, the discoveries of that generation really fueled the technological revolution, the computer revolution, all the revolutions that we're seeing now in technology. But sometimes I think my dad and his generation looks back and kind of just shakes his head and thinks, what did we do? What did we start? Sometimes I just see my dad and I think he just kind of shakes his head going, oh my gosh, you know, all these changes, it's a lot. And so it's that unprecedented speed of change that has caused a considerable amount of anxiety and concern and fear, as it should. Our world is in transition, very much so. Our community is in transition. It's no surprise, then, that our church is, and rightly should be, in transition. In a community that and world that is rapidly transforming. I want to say, I don't like that necessarily. It wasn't my idea. If I had a vote in it, I would vote against it. But the truth is, it is transforming rapidly the world all around us. It's a statement of fact. It's just happening. There's nothing we can do. You can't put the genie back in the bottle. It is happening all around us. And so, in a community and world that is rapidly transitioning, a church that is not transitioning is irrelevant and on the way to death. Now, this has not always been true. There have been in human history stretches of 200 or 300 years where there's been very little change. But it has never been more true today. The world is changing. So I want to talk a little bit about the dynamics of change and what that means for us as a church. And remember, I'm taking 2 hours of material, taking it into about 30 minutes, hopefully. I want to get you out of here by 8 o'clock if possible. If Bill hadn't taken so long, you know, we would have been, no, I'm just kidding, Bill. It was a good presentation, brother. I want to do it in three kind of phases. I want to talk about the dynamics of change personally, how it impacts us personally, how we're wired for change. And each one of us is wired for change. You may not think you are, but you are wired for change. We're just wired differently for it. So I want to talk about it personal. Then I want to talk about it from a corporate perspective. Now, how do people handle change? And then how are churches wired for change? Corporately, how do churches react to or deal with change? And then I want to talk about particular. What does change look like or mean for, literally for us, First Baptist Church of Richardson? So we're talking personal, then corporate in general, churches, and then First Richardson. We're going to get to there, the end. So if you want to know First Richardson, you got to stay, so you can't leave. Personal. Malcolm Gladwell, in his book, The Tipping Point, which is a book that studies epidemics, in other words, how epidemics work, how they start, in other words, how change happens, talks about the different personalities of change. I want to go through them very quickly, and he even does a percentage of population of change, the personalities of change. These describe different people. You may see yourself in here. If you do, don't yell it out loud, okay? But the first is what he calls pathfinders. Sometimes they're called visionaries. Sometimes they're called revolutionaries. And it's about 2.5% of the population in general. These are people who see things that are not yet happened. These are people who can see ahead and who can see what no one else can see. And then they use their creative and passionate energy in an attempt to move people in the direction of the vision. They see things before anyone else does. And that's wonderful. The negative side to pathfinders is that they can also be very destructive, because they're usually fairly obtuse as to why you don't see it. And pathfinders have a way, too, of destroying organizations and institutions, because they see it and they're driving towards it, and they're going to run over you on the way over there, okay? So pathfinders have positives and negatives, as each one of these personalities does. The second are what Gladwell calls listeners, about 12.5% of the population. And listeners are those who actually understand the pathfinders. Most people just want to crucify the pathfinders. Most people despise the path, but listeners understand the pathfinders. They hear them. They can see the vision that the pathfinder describes, and then they have a way of interpreting it for everyone else. They take the information from the pathfinder and they make it palatable. They're the diplomats. They can make it palatable for everybody else to hear and understand. So they're very important. They're interpreters of the vision. By the way, in case you're interested, I think that I'm a listener. I'm not really that much of a pathfinder. I'm not a revolutionary type, radical kind of leader like that. But I am more of a listener. I can take vision and ideas and I can interpret in ways that other people can catch on to. In case you're interested, I put myself in the listener part. Now, the listener has some negatives, too. They can become very impatient with the pace of change. It frustrates them because it's not going fast enough. But the biggest danger with the listener is that the listener is very articulate, but not much of an organizer. Thank you very much. The listener is articulate, but not very much of an organizer, typically, and can get bogged down with the execution and the implementation of the vision, so that it never winds up happening. The listener loves talking about the vision, loves these esoteric conversations, and loves painting the picture. But then, what have you done today? Well, not a whole lot. But look at the picture. Isn't it beautiful? And so that can be a negative. The next are the organizers. About 30% of the population typically are organizers. The organizers don't get the pathfinders, but they come to trust and understand the listener. The listener interprets the vision for the organizers, and the organizers, they don't have to see it happening before they start doing it, because they trust themselves that they can make it happen. The organizer is the one who says, help me understand the vision, then I can work towards it and make it happen. And these people are very, very extremely important. One of the negatives is the organizers are at heart conservative, and they thrive on routine. So they can get the vision eventually, and they can make it their routine, and eventually it becomes a system that feeds on itself, but they're very important. The next group are followers, about 40% according to Gladwell. Followers will not actively work against change, but they will sit back and watch to see if it's going to work. See, a follower wants to know, first of all, okay, yeah, it sounds fancy and all that, but I want to see it work. And so they have a little bit harder time trusting. They can maybe understand the vision, but they're not going to jump on board right away. By the way, the listeners are often also called early adopters. They'll take an idea before it's even been tried, and they'll jump on board right away. Whereas followers say, I want to see whether or not this is going to be a disaster first, and then I might jump on board. So once the followers come to trust the listener and the organizer, the followers don't like the pathfinders. Followers can't stand pathfinders. Pathfinders get crucified a lot, okay? Jesus was a pathfinder, by the way. He was a visionary. He was a revolutionary. So the followers don't like the pathfinders. But if the followers feel a lack of trust or a betrayal at any point, they can easily jump off board. Okay. So that's very important. Trust is very, very important in all of this. Very important. So then the last group are what Gladwell calls patriots. 15% of the population. Patriots are firmly rooted in tradition and proven practices. They provide stability and a much needed link to history and tradition, legacy. And they fight hard for proven methods and demand that leadership be thoughtful in any kind of change process. Those are the positives of patriots. The negatives are they can't stand change. And oftentimes work proactively against change. Very vocal. And patriots typically will sit back and wait and look for any sign of failure in whatever changes have been made so they can stand up against that. Now, that's in the worst case scenario, they can become stuck in old ways and can become blind to any change, viable or not. That's a worst case scenario. But I do want to say they provide an important piece. All of these are necessary in an institution, organization, in a church. All of these people are, whatever way you're wired, God wired you that way. If you're a patriot, I want to tell you, God made you a patriot. God bless you. Tradition and history and legacy is important. And they're, not all change is good. Not all change works. And so then God put the pathfinders in our world to point it out every time that it's not good, okay? And so it's just you can't get stuck in the never wanting to change loop, okay? I want you to see a diagram of how this works out in the church very quickly. What does this look like in the church? If we have the church here and we say, this is the church. Here's something I want you to see. This is very important to understand, I think, when you're talking about the dynamics of how a church works. You have the pathfinders that Gladwell says are about 2.5% of the population. So there you have pathfinders, just 2.5% of the population of the church. This is the whole church. And the pathfinders, remember, the ones that want to try everything, want to change for the sake of change, just change it. Well, it's working. I'll just change it anyway. I'm bored with it. And they just want to do something new all the time. They're kind of the ones that are always pushing the envelope, okay? Drive me crazy. Anyway. On the other side of the spectrum, you have the patriots, who, remember, are about 15% of the population. And they're the ones that are usually want to kill the pathfinders and just don't like any change at all, for the most part. Both of these, the pathfinders and the patriots, are rather, to be honest with you, famous for destroying churches, destroying institutions. When it becomes dysfunctional. Because the pathfinders and the patriots in some ways are the most passionate. The pathfinders are passionate for change and for progress and for moving forward. And the patriots are passionate for history and tradition and legacy. And both of those are all good. And they're passionate about that. So because they're passionate, guess what? They're the most vocal. They're the loudest voices. And the mistake that a lot of churches make and a lot of institutions make, I believe, is that they listen to those voices because they're the loudest. But guess who gets lost? Listeners, organizers, followers, 82.5% of the church, what I call the big middle. The big middle that gets torn apart and lost because I spend all of my energy running to the pathfinders, then running to the patriots, and then running back and forth because they're the loudest and the most passionate and the most vocal. They believe in what they're saying. And what they're saying is not bad. It's just that you forget the big middle. The 82.5% of the church is saying, you know what? I'm pretty happy. I kind of like it. So here's what I want to say about this really quickly. I just want to make one quick conclusion. I want you to hear me and hear me well. I love patriots. My dad's a patriot. He's been in the church. They've been in that church for 55 years. And every new pastor that comes in, they'll tell him, I've been here longer than you've been. You're going to be here and gone. I'll still be here. They don't care. You want to make all these? You're going to be gone. I'm still going to be here. My dad's a patriot. He's been here. He's been at church 54 years, has seen all kinds of changes, has been against every one of them. I love patriots. And I love pathfinders. But here's what I want to say. We cannot allow the pathfinders or the patriots to drive the church, because they will drive it into the ground. Not that they want to. It's just the way it works. Pathfinders have a way of destroying churches. And I can point to churches in our convention that had been destroyed with some young guy coming in, a pathfinder who wants to just change everything right away and just blows the church apart. And you probably know churches like that. Pathfinders have a reputation for exploding churches. And patriots, if you get a church full of patriots, they suffocate and stagnate the church. No change. So to the pathfinders in the room, if you're a pathfinder, I love you. I do. We need your energy, your excitement, creative ideas, but we will not allow you to destroy our church by going too fast towards a vision that we're still trying to understand. And I want to say to you, if you're a pathfinder, that we want others to come along with us on the journey who aren't ready, and we aren't going to get there as fast as you would like. But we're going to get there. We're going to get there, just not as fast as you would like. So stay with us. To the patriots, I would say, I love you. We need your stability, your thoughtfulness, and your time-proven observations, but we will not let you create our agenda. We will not let you stagnate the forward movement of the church just because you can't get all your questions answered. Because you have 100 questions. And as soon as I answer those 100, you'll have 100 more ready for me. We will move forward with or without you, but we want it to be with you. So please hear me on that. So that's a quick crash course on the personalities of change, personal. Some common reactions to change, well, you know them, you've experienced them: fear, anxiety, rebellion. And rebellion comes in two ways, as far as I'm concerned. There are those who rebel against change, but they stay and fight against the change. That's a form of rebellion against change. But the other form of rebellion is that they leave, go to another church down the street. And I think that's another form of kind of a rebellion that's more passive. So, and people do that. It's common. It just happens. Capitulation is really just another form of passive-aggressive kind of, I don't like the change, but I'm going to hang around. I'm just going to go to my little Sunday school class and talk to them and go home. And, you know, that kind of, I don't like the change. It's kind of just capitulating to it. And then what I call dialectic confrontation, from several of the philosophers of the Hume, is the most famous for the understanding the dialectic. It's those who actually confront change, ask the questions of the problems, and then synthesize. So that's what dialectic means. It means you have two sides, they come together, and neither one of them wins. You synthesize, and it's something new. So people who take change by confronting it, kind of wrestling with it, and then coming up with something different. It's a synthesis process, and I think, personally, it's the most healthy. But these are common reactions to change. Gordon MacDonald, let's move, these are personal. Let's move to the corporate. Churches. Churches take on personalities. It's fascinating the way churches take on personalities. I've done a little bit of studying on that, how churches, the scary thing is that over time, I'm talking 15, 20 years, over time, a church starts to take on the personality of its senior pastor. Oh, that's really scary, very scary. I don't like that. I don't like that at all. I just know it's true. And so if you have a pastor who is legalistic and hard and demanding, then over time, you get a church that's legalistic and hard and demanding. You have a pastor who is full of grace and love and welcoming, then over time you get a church that's full of grace and love. It's the way it happens. I don't like it. It scares me, but I think it's true. Gordon MacDonald, in his book, Who Stole My Church? What to Do When the Church You Love Tries to Enter the 21st Century, exposes in narrative form some of the common and understandable feelings you might experience when your church starts to change. Here are some of the things you may feel, start to feel or think. It doesn't feel like my church anymore. It's a very common feeling. It's understandable. So you, with that, you deal with sadness, loneliness, and grief. It's a grieving process because you feel like you're losing something. This is my church, and it just doesn't feel like my church anymore. And so there's a loss, just like you would lose anybody else. You go through a grieving process. Another one that he identifies, I don't like the leader or leaders. People take their frustrations, their anger, their fear of change, and they project it usually on the leader, in this case, senior pastor, or leadership. So you get feelings of anger, sadness again, and righteous indignation sometimes. I'm right, he's wrong, I don't like him. What's not to like? Come on. Anyway, so that happens though. That's understandable. It really is. And listen, I want you to know this is just an aside. I get anonymous notes every once in a while. Anytime I get an anonymous note, I know it's not going to be good because, you know, most anonymous notes are negative. I wish you wouldn't send anonymous notes, really, because I can't have a conversation with someone who sends an anonymous note. I would love to have a conversation with them, but I can't because I don't know who it is. So I want you to know, you can send me, I won't be upset or angry. I want to have the conversations. I think that's important. But this is a natural. Another one that's similar to this is I don't like where things are headed. You see, that's taking the fear and the anxiety and all that you're feeling, but instead of projecting it onto the leader, maybe you actually like the leader. Maybe you even love the leader. And you don't want to project it on the leader, so you project it on the direction or the programs or whatever. It's basically the same thing. You're just projecting the fear and the anxiety onto something else as opposed to the leader, because you kind of genuinely like the leader. Hopefully that's the case here. Anyway, you get anger, you get frustration, isolation. You feel like you're alienated. And then that really leads us to the other one, which is a very common one. I don't feel like I have a say anymore. I just don't feel like I have a say anymore. Oh, this is an old one. This goes all the way back to Moses, telling you. I don't feel like I have a say anymore, which brings alienation, anger, and frustration. And oftentimes, nothing about the polity of the church has changed. The way churches make decisions, nothing has changed. The decisions are being made the way they've always been made. It's just that you don't like the outcome of them. And so you start to feel like I don't have a say, when really you have just as much a say as you've ever had. It's the same system. But really what's happening is this, the emotion. It's the alienation, the anger, the frustration. All these things are understandable. All these things happen across the spectrum in churches everywhere. So then a church begins to develop this personality, and it begins to deal with things in particular ways. So let me go through, and this is from the book Dying for Change by Leif Anderson. It's an old book, but I think it's a very prophetic book, an amazingly prophetic book. It was written in the 1990s, early 90s, but you read it today, and it's just so appropriate. Church responses to change. These are different types of churches and how they deal with change. There's first is the resistant church. This is the church that fights hard to keep things the way they are. And listen, resistance is not all bad. Many of the values and practices of modern society are not better than the old ways. They're not. Bigger is not always better. I mean, I know that's heresy in Texas to say bigger is not always better, but it's not. Those who resist change can demonstrate courage, persistence, and security. It takes an enormous amount of institutional ego to stand alone when almost all others think you're wrong. So not all resistance is necessarily bad. There are forces in our culture that we should be resisting. So not all resistance is bad. But not all resistance is rooted in moral principle either. Much resistance is a result of personal and institutional insecurity. We're just afraid. A fear of change that results in isolation. In extreme cases, the leaders and members of the church refuse to acknowledge the changes occurring all around them. It's the burying your head in the sand. It's not nothing's changing, nothing's changing, nothing's changing, nothing's changing, and not really wanting to look at the reality of what's all around you. Or a church takes on the personality of criticizing all the changes and those who are embracing them. Oh, so that church down the road, you know, they've got a coffee bar in their foyer now. Oh, back in my day, you didn't drink coffee in the church. Unless it was in the fellowship hall. See, so we begin to take the changes we see happening around us, and those churches typically become known for what they're against. Drives me crazy. One of my pet peeves growing up is the Baptists. We were known for what we were against. I want to be known for what we're for, not what we're against. And it's a danger to fall into again today. That's the resistant church. Then there's the nostalgic church. The church that keeps hoping that tomorrow will be 1974 again, okay? Or 1954, or whatever year was your favorite year in church. You go back and look at the 1950s. Oh, weren't the 1950s wonderful? It was a different world. Everything was so wonderful and nice and all of that. Well, not if you were black and lived in the South, it wasn't. People got divorced in the 1950s. You know, nostalgia does something to you, right? And it's not reality. But even if it were, even if 1974 or 54 were that great, this church reminisces for the golden age of their church, whenever that year was, when we were doing so great, and just wishes that it could be that way again, and thinks as soon as we get past this latest fad, then we're going to be back to where we were in 1974 or 84 or 54. It just doesn't happen. It creates a negative, a cognitive dissonance for your people who are trying to live out there in the 21st century, and they come to church and it's still in the 20th century. It creates problems for your people. Your church stops being relevant to the world out there because you come back and you're in a time warp over here, still trying to live in the 1970s. And the truth of the matter is, there is no going back. The church that doesn't understand this becomes obsolete. Whatever tomorrow's church is going to look like, it will bear little resemblance to the church you loved in the 1970s. It's just not going to look like that. In the year 2000, this church was running 2,000 in worship. I looked at the records. It's true. In the year 2000, that was only, 13 years ago. In the year 2000, this church was running 2,000 in worship. I don't know how y'all did it. I don't know where you stuffed everybody. But that's where you were running. And this church will do 2,000 in worship again. I know it will. I'm absolutely confident of that. This church will do 2,000 in worship again. But when we're running 2,000 in worship again in the year 2020 or whenever that happens, it's not going to look anything like the church that you were in 2000, the year 2000. It's not going to look anything like that. It's going to look completely different. I hate that. Because this was a great church in the year 2000. But you can't go back there. It doesn't work that way. The neighborhood has changed. The community has changed. Everything has changed. This church will never look like that again. Ever. So what we have to do is have a little bit of a funeral of our expectations and kind of bury them. And start getting excited about what it will look like. Whatever it'll look like in 2020 or whenever, when we're running 2,000 in worship again. Mark told me 2015. Okay. Whenever it is, it's going to look different. Then there's the try harder church. Let me run through these. I'm taking too long. This is the church that works harder but not always smarter. Generally wants to relate to the world today. It wants to win the world, not resist the world. The try harder church is devoted to doing the same things better rather than trying to be better by doing different things. And often this logic grows out of, very, very sane logic, it grows out of previous successes. So that this is what worked in the year 2000, when we were running 2000 in worship, this is what we were doing that worked, let's just do it again, but try harder. And guess what? It doesn't work. This is not the year 2000 anymore. That's so last week. That's how fast things are changing. So the innovations we try are simply the old ideas wrapped in new packages. Just the old ideas wrapped in new packages. The heart is in the right place. They're hardworking. But they don't recognize that yesterday's methods can be counterproductive. Einstein said it, insanity is doing the same things over and over again and expecting different results. This doesn't work. The Surrender Church. This actually is one of the most realistic churches and insightful churches. This is a church that truly understands itself and its relationship to modern society. And on the basis of that understanding, it concludes that it cannot change, will not change, or is simply being swept away by change. It's a church that basically surrenders and says, I give up. And we're not going to change. We can't change. And so we're just going to die. And they recognize that. This happens all over, especially in inner city. Happens all over. It happens in ethnic churches, which is the kind of church I grew up in, where they struggle because they reach first-generation immigrants who speak the language, whatever language, whether it's Spanish or Chinese or whatever. They all have the same issues. Is that they reach that first generation that speaks the language, but the second and third generation don't speak the language anymore. And so the church has to decide, are we going to change to cater to our kids? And if not, they go off and they join the big white church. Well, of course they do. They speak English in the big white church. And your kids don't speak Spanish. My kids, they know taco burrito, they know the Taco Bell menu, taco burrito chalupa. And they say it that way, chalupa. Well, they're Americans. Of course they do. They haven't even been to Mexico. So that the Hispanic churches, the Spanish-speaking churches struggle with this. They become irrelevant to the next generation. It's a big struggle. They surrender. A lot of churches do that. The entrepreneurial church. Oh, I could go on for hours about this one. Let me just say very quickly, because I'm running way out of time. What time do you have to be home? Anyway, this was a popular and sometimes exciting response to the changes of the late 20th century. These churches are usually founded by capable, charismatic leaders who saw a need and ventured to fill it. If I told you some of their names, you would know who I was talking about. Robert Schuller in the Crystal Cathedral way back. He was one of the first ones. Bill Hybels, Willow Creek Church. Rick Warren, Saddleback Community Church. These entrepreneurial churches start by one or a few motivated leaders who welcome the risk and the adventure of doing something new. They are market sensitive and attempt to take current trends and needs into consideration using the latest up-to-date methods. Part of the attraction of these churches is the lack of tradition, that there's literally no one to say, we've never done it that way before. No creeds, no liturgy, no building at first and for a long time. No budget, no history, everything is new and fresh. There are problems with these churches. Sometimes, terrible problems. Not all of them, but sometimes there are terrible problems with these churches, serious problems. Most of the pastors are strong, dynamic leaders, but are not theologically trained. As the leader goes, so goes the church. There is little true accountability for the charismatic leader. There is no one there to say, we've never done it that way before. And sometimes you need somebody there to say, we've never done it that way before. It's a way of thinking very carefully through what you're doing and why. I love when somebody tells me, why are you doing, why? Because it makes me think things through and be sure I know why. These churches can do a lot of good, but they also have the potential to do a lot of harm. And the jury is still out on them. They're a relatively new phenomenon in church work in America, and we still don't know all the ramifications of the harm that they may be doing to people. It's interesting, Bill Hybels, who's one of the most well-known of these pastors who started one of these churches, Bill Hybels recently wrote a book talking about all the things that they did wrong, all the places where they failed. It's very interesting. It was a very honest book. So that's the entrepreneurial church. And the last one is the renewing church, what I call the dialectic church. The renewing church is established and stable and willing to capitalize on that stability in an ongoing quest for relevance. This church values both tradition and change. It makes an effort to know theology and sociology, to be faithful to orthodoxy and practical to people. It strives to stay true to the basic principles that have made the church great throughout the centuries, so it's always tied to its legacy and its tradition, but is also astute in knowing how to fulfill those principles in new and innovative ways. It's the principles that are important, The principles that throughout the centuries have always made the church great. Love your neighbor. It's a principle, you see. Not the methods. The methods change, but the principle, it's important. So renewing churches are always, they stay hold true to their tradition, their principles of their traditions, but willing to make changes in methods and the way they were presenting those principles. Okay? Renewal is ongoing. Okay, as you can see, I like that one the most, but we can talk more about that later if you want to. Let me go to our to now the particulars of church, because I have like less than 5 minutes left. Okay. Let me just talk about us now. I've talked about how individuals handle change. That typically, by the way, is like about 45 minutes of my conference. And then how churches tend to handle change collectively. We talked about those different types of churches. Let's talk about what it means for us as a church, First Baptist Church Richardson. And let me begin by telling you what it does not mean. What I'm not talking about when I say change. When I say change, I'm not talking about music. Okay? Just not. I love all kinds of music. I could care less what music you sing, okay? If you can worship with God, if you're worshiping God with it, fantastic, sing it. This is not about music. And I think a lot of churches make a big mistake when they go straight to the music and start trying to change the music and thinking like that's going to solve everything. It just doesn't. It's wrong-headed. And I'll even say this. As long as I'm the pastor here, my main goal is to help you, the ones who show up to worship, to be a worshiping church. And so there will always be a place in our church for you to worship with the music that you, if you love hymns, there will always be a place for you to worship with hymns in our church, as long as I'm the pastor. After you fire me, I can't promise you anything, okay, whoever comes next, but as long as I'm the pastor, there will always be a place for you to worship with the music that you love. Now, we have to live with other people, so we have to be able to compromise and do a little of this, a little of that, but you'll always have hymns to sing. It's not about music. It's not about Sunday school, even though we changed the name. I know. I put Sunday school up there on purpose, by the way. I didn't forget. I am not going to change. I have no desire to come in and divide or destroy the community that you have in your Sunday school class. Those people that some of you have been with for years, they're your family. That teacher who has been ministering to you and teaching you the Bible for years, I have no desire to come in and destroy that or mess with that or change that at all. But, I mean, in fact, I want you to have that. That's an important part of being church, is to have that community. And so if any of the changes that we make are going to hurt that, then we're going to be very careful to not hurt, try not to hurt that. Okay. Polity or ecclesiology. I have no desire to change the way we make decisions. We make decisions the way most Baptist churches make the decisions. I mean, what we have is basically patterned after our great American democracy. We have what is called representative democracy. That's what America has. America does not have true democracy, in case you're wondering, when you study political science. True democracy means you vote on everything. If we had a true democracy, we would vote on what color toilet paper to put in the restrooms, okay? We would vote on everything. And we have representative democracy. That means you elect committee members to act as your representatives. They make important decisions. And there are some decisions that are so important that the whole church needs to make. When we call a pastor, you're going to approve whoever we call. That's an important decision. I believe in that. I'm glad for that. If we're going to build a new building or something, you're going to vote on. That's something you have to vote on. It's a whole church, not just a committee. So there are things that the whole church decides. There are things that committees decide. There are things that the church has given the pastor and staff freedom to create and decide. And we're not going to change that. There's no need to change that. Theological essentials. I'm not going to go into this. You know what I'm talking about. There are theological fundamentals. Jesus Christ is the one and only true Son of God, Father, Son, Holy Spirit, born of a virgin, the true incarnation, real miracles of Jesus Christ, died a substitutionary death on the cross, rose physical, bodily resurrection from the dead, conquering sin and death, ascended into heaven, sitting at the right hand of the throne of God, coming back someday for his church. Okay. Can I get him in? Okay. All right. We're not going to change any of that. The theological doctrinal principles stay the same. They're timeless. They're our historic beliefs. That's what we believe. Beyond that, we have to talk. We interpret different ways and different things. But those fundamentals, I am a fundamentalist in my theology, not in my politics. not in my worldview, but in what I believe in the Bible. I believe in the fundamentals that I just described, and so do you, and those are not going to change. Baptist identity, we're not taking the name Baptist off the sign, okay? I know all of you are just so greatly relieved now. We're Baptists. I mean, we're Baptists. I mean, what do you mean, the first what? We're the first Baptist Church of Richardson. And I know that can be baggage and that can be, that hurts us. It does. Baptists have a bad name in case you haven't figured it out. They have a bad name in the community. I'm sorry. It hurts us, but it's who we are. We're not going to try to be something else. We'll just try to be the most loving. We'll try to change it. We'll just try to be the most loving Baptist church we can be. We're not going to change our Baptist identity, okay? I'm not talking about those things. Here's what I am talking about. Focus. We have a focus. We have a vision statement. Our vision statement says this. We exist to make disciples of Jesus Christ by connecting people to a small community of fellow Christians who learn from the Word of God, engage in the worship of God, and serve the mission of God. That's our vision, what we want to do. We want to make disciples of Jesus Christ. We do it through connect, learn, worship, serve. That is our singular focus, okay? Now, I'm getting to something here in a little while. Stay with me. That is our singular focus. In addition to that singular focus, you, all of you have given me a mandate. I've talked with hundreds of you, and over again, you have given me as your leader a single mandate. From the youngest to the oldest, in one way or another, you have said this. You have said this to me. Reach young families. That's what you've told me over and over and over and over again. I'm talking from the youngest, the 18-year-old is the youngest I've interviewed, and the 92-year-old is the oldest I've interviewed. And the 92-year-old was the most adamant, saying, Pastor, you've got to reach young families. So that's our mandate. It's a clear mandate. And what I mean by focus is that we take that vision statement, and we take that mandate, and we make all of our decisions through that prism based on that. Good ideas. They're all Christian ideas. Oh, Pastor, we need to do this. Or we need to do this. Or let's do this. Or I want to start this. They've all been great ideas, wonderful ideas. And so what happens when you say yes to everything is that you become the dog chasing its own tail. And you're a very busy church, a very busy, busy church. I mean, you are a busy, busy church. Going nowhere because you have no focus, no direction, because you don't know how to say no. And I'm going to get really good at saying no, and you're not going to like it. I'm just telling you ahead of time. Some of you aren't going to like it because you're not going to understand, why can't we do this? Because we're not going to do it. Because you have to have focus. And you'll never have focus if you don't develop the discipline of saying no. No. Yeah, it's a great idea. Let me give you a list of churches in our community that might like it, but we're not going to do it because we're already doing enough and we have a focus and we have a mandate. Okay? Very important, focus. That's going to change. It's going to change pretty rapidly. And you're going to hear no a lot, I think. And I'm sorry about that. But otherwise, we'll never have focus, and we'll never go anywhere. All right, another one is administrative processes. We've already started this. Don't want to spend a lot of time on it. Organizational changes. All of it is geared towards effectiveness and efficiency. We have, limited resources. Everyone deals with that. The church is not a business, okay? The church is not a business. Please don't tell people that Ellis thinks the church is a business. I'm here on record to say the church is not a business. The church is an organism. It's a body. It's a living, breathing creation of God. I do not believe that the church is a business. But there are aspects to what even you do with your body that are business-like, right? You take care of it, hopefully. You groom in the morning, right? You have all your tools for grooming, some more than others. You shower once a week, whether you need it or not. You do things that are business-like with your body. Everybody has a business aspect to it. The church has a business aspect to it. It's not a business, but it has a business aspect to it. And in that business aspect to the church, to our church life, we're going to become effective and efficient. And the saying no is part of all that. But I'm determined to do that. That's the engineer in me. Okay, you called an engineer to be your pastor. That's your fault. Okay. Administrative process and leadership staff. One of the Biggest things I'm doing right now, one of my biggest tasks coming on as your pastor is to build the team, the leadership team that's going to take the church the next 20 years. I probably won't be here 20 years from now. I'm 51. I don't plan on going until I'm 70, in case you're wondering. I don't plan on it. But I'm building the team that's going to take us the next 20 years. And it's developing a balance between experience and young energy. And so we're already beginning to work on that, and we're on the process. There have been a couple of things that have been the focus of that. One is our vision. Connect, learn, worship, serve. So we have a connect pastor, a learn pastor, a worship pastor, a serve pastor. You see how our staff is already fitting our vision. The other is our mandate, reach young families. So we are trying to tweak and change things so that we focus on young families. We have a youth minister, a children's minister, youth minister, preschool minister, children's minister who focus on young families. We are going to move our, and the personnel committee has already approved this, we're going to move our preschool minister, Elisa Tiffy, into a position of family pastor. And her number one focus is going to be to reach young families. And she's going to work with the team of a new preschool minister who you'll vote on sometime in the future. Preschool minister, children's minister, and youth minister. But the whole changing of the reorganization is because of our mandate. See, it's all fueled by our vision and our mandate. We will also eventually, probably sometime at the end of this year, be bringing in an executive pastor to run our church effectively, efficiently in the administrative and organizational side. Let me just show you really quick why, what I do. These are the three circles of pastoring. I teach this to young pastors. These are the three things pastors do. We do proclamation, which is preaching and teaching, witnessing, talking to people about Jesus. It's proclamation. I do pastoral care. It's hospitals, nursing homes, weddings, funerals, pastoral care, and we do leadership. From leading the staff, mentoring the staff, developing young leaders in our church, committees, all those kinds of things. So I do all these. And early on, I met with the deacon officers, and I told them that as I saw the church and what the church needed me to do was that I couldn't do all three of these. I just can't. Not in this church, not right now. There's too much to be done. I can't do all three of these. And I told them, you know, proclamation, preaching, and teaching, I probably needed to still do. People tend to frown on it when I don't show up on Sunday, okay, to preach. So I've got to preach. So I said, here are the other two. I said, I know how to do this. I've done it my whole 20 years of ministry. I love this. I love doing this. I know how to do it. And I think I know how to lead our church where it needs to go. I think that I am uniquely qualified to do that, prepared. God has prepared me to do this. I believe that. I can do that. I just told the deacons, I can't do both. I'll lose my family. I'm not going to do that. I just can't do both. So you tell me which one you want me to do. And they said, let Gerald do that. You do this. I said, Okay. That's what they told me. You're deacons. So for probably the last year and a half, 2 years, that's what I've been doing. And not just Gerald, Bill Webb and Candy, the others, they do pastoral care. And I've done very little pastoral care because I've been overwhelmed with leadership. So we need an executive pastor to come in and to be able to do that leadership piece for me so that I can get back to pastoral care and preaching and teaching and casting vision, which are the things I do best. I tell you why, because I believe that pastoral care, I need to do that for my preaching. I don't think that I can be the preacher God wants me to be if I'm not doing more pastoral care. And so I need an executive pastor to come in and just run things for me so that I can get out of that business. Plus, I'm not that good at it, so that too. Okay, so that's going to happen. You'll be voting on the person when that time comes, all right? So that's a leadership staff, and then facilities. Let me just say this. Our facilities are not up to par with what's happening out there in the world today. They just aren't. Now, I know some of you are going to disagree with me, and that's great. I love disagreement because it starts a conversation. And I would love to talk. If you disagree with me on this, I'm not going to spend any time on this. I'm just going to tell you our facilities are not up to par. They're not. But if you want to have that conversation, here's how it's going to happen. First, you're going to put three hours aside of a day, and we're going to spend 3 hours together. The first hour, you're going to buy me lunch. That's the first thing. And we're going to talk. And then the second hour, we're going to go together to about three or four churches all around us, and we're going to tour their facilities. And then we're going to come back here, and then we're going to talk. Because I'm not going to talk to you out of ignorance that really all you've ever seen is this church, and you've never been anywhere else that's close by. But you go to three or four churches around here, and you'll come back to the office, and you will agree with me. We are not up to par on our facilities. So we're going to be talking more about that in the future. That's going to change. And then communications technology, I think that speaks for itself. We just have to communicate better. Texting, website, email, and just a new way of communicating. We will continue to do snail mail for those who really need it, and there are people in our church who really need it, and we don't want to leave them out. So we'll continue to do it for those who really need it, and we want to do that. But for everybody else, we're going to go to email, texting, and Facebook, and worship guide, of course, and announcements, but we just have to communicate differently to be more effective and efficient, okay? These are the changes I'm talking about when I talk about changes, all right? I'm way out of time. I've taken way more time than what I promised I would take. I apologize for that, but I hope this has helped you. And if you have any questions you want to talk, I really am open to talking. I love to talk about these things. So you buy me lunch and we'll talk, and I promise we will. So you let me know. You email me. I'm serious about that. You email me and we can talk. Let me pray. Father, we thank you for all that you give us and all that you are. We thank you for our church that we love, and we know that you love it. And we thank you for all that you're going to do with these. I thank you for all that you're going to do with these precious people, your children. I thank you for all you've already done, amazing things with them and in their lives. And I know you'll do it again. Bless us this day, we pray in Jesus' name. Amen. Amen. God bless you.